Time now for Crime and Punishment, our check-in each week with Casey McNerthney from the King County Prosecutor's Office. And I wanted to bring up an issue that a lot of our listeners have been worried about. When a felony crime is committed and the defendant's immigration status is in question, does that get followed up? Does the immigration part matter? I asked Casey who handles cases in those circumstances.
The short answer is that's federal immigration authorities. The way the law is written, county prosecutors don't have the ability to handle that one way or the other. And here's the easy way to remember it. For gross misdemeanors, that goes to the cities at the city attorney's level. For felony crimes, that goes to the county, which is us. For immigration matters, that goes to federal immigration authorities. And so when you have a situation like this, the example in Snohomish County is a good one to walk through it. So when you have a situation like the case in Snohomish County, that's a good one to walk through, because at the same time that prosecutors at the county level get the vehicular homicide case, immigration authorities at the federal level get the immigration concern. And so that can either go from the investigating police agency to the federal immigration folks, or the federal immigration folks can go down to the police agency that investigates and say, hey, can we get information here? And the reason why it doesn't go to county prosecutors is because we can't do anything on it anyway because of the way the law is written.
So it'd be up to the arresting officers or the investigating officers to figure out what the immigration status is.
Right, if they're able to, or the other way, or for the federal authorities to work and contact them directly to say, we'd like information about XYZ. The reason why it's not prosecutors is because we're acting on information that we get from the police investigators anyway.
Yeah. Now, are there police investigators, are there agencies which are still prohibited from disclosing or using in any way the immigration status of a suspect?
I don't know offhand. In most cases that we see where it's mentioned, in fact, every case where it's definitively mentioned that I can think of, the federal immigration authorities are already in contact with police.
Uh-huh. So whose job is it then the federal immigration authorities are not just going to be following police around checking immigration status. I don't think they have the manpower to do that. But suppose somebody finds out or sees it on the news. Whose responsibility is it to say, and I'm not saying you should do this, but I mean, I'm just trying to give people who are concerned about this what their options are. Do ordinary citizens watching the TV news call up ICE and say, hey, did you know this guy was here illegally?
That's a good question. I don't know if that would be something that would go to the federal folks first or to the police investigators first, and then they would communicate with each other. And the reason why I'm not sure on that one is just because we're not involved in it, because by law, the responsibility goes to those other agencies.
Yeah. Now, your interaction with the immigration issue is that you're trying to get people who might not have their documents to trust you when they're witnesses to a crime, correct?
That's the most common place that we see it. So the two most common places that county prosecutors see it are just like the Snohomish County case, where you have somebody who has an immigration concern. It's already noted at the time that it gets to the county prosecutors. But really, the most common place that we see it in the cases we handle are when victims and witnesses self-identify as someone who has an immigration concern. And that's tough because they say, I don't want to come forward as a witness. I don't want to come forward as a victim. And we don't want people to be victimized repeatedly. So our message is, regardless of who you are, if you're victimized, we'll go after the person who committed that felony crime.
And if you're victimized, you are not going to inquire as to immigration status.
Right.
Is that fair to say?
Right. At the prosecutor level, yeah.
And the context of this discussion is that vehicular homicide case in Snohomish County where the state trooper was killed and the person who caused the crash turns out was here illegally. Casey McNerthney is a spokesman of the King County Prosecutor's Office. I also wanted to ask Casey about this report from the King County Sexual Assault Resource Center, which raised concerns about the number of sexual assault cases in King County that ended in a plea agreement. In other words, the charges were reduced. So I asked him to explain, why would you reduce the charges in cases like this?
A lot of people, understandably, ask the question of why would you ever plea any case that involves sexual assault? And so I asked Maggie Chirimi, who is the chairperson of the unit at the King County Courthouse, who handles these cases exactly, and here's how she explained it.
The truth is, in SAU, we consider every single case individually. We assess the case when it comes in for filing. We often send it back to the detective to ask for more investigation. When that happens and we feel that we can file a case, we assess it again for filing and file it. We reassess the case when it goes through our early plea unit to see whether or not this case is going to withstand muster at trial. The trial DPA who receives the case for trial assesses it again to make sure that it is actually going to go to trial. So we evaluate the strength of our evidence at every level. And as you see in this report, many of these cases are taken forward to trial. But our system is not built on taking every single case to trial, nor does that make sense in every single case, as evidence does change with time. And so the number that you see here is a reflection of that reality.
What she's saying there is that if you look at any county across Washington or other parts of the nation, you'd see a similar plea rate. So that kind of begs the next question of, so what's that like for victims? How does the system work for them? What's the process walking through a case like this with them? And here's how Maggie explained it.
Of course, we work very hard to make sure that we have victim input as much as possible. If a victim wants to be very engaged with us, we offer that opportunity. If victims want to not communicate as much, we also honor that request. We try very hard to meet victims where they are. Nonetheless, when there is a plea being negotiated, we work very hard to let the victim know upfront what it is the defendant has endorsed, to take the time they need to think about it and to get back to us. Sometimes we ask them to get back to us in a shorter period of time, depending on where the case is on the trial track. Sometimes we allow longer period of time. If a victim asks for extra time, we try to ask the court to allow for that opportunity for the victim. As we negotiate pleas, victims sometimes will make specific requests in cases, and where those requests are appropriate and they make sense, we go back to the defense team and make those requests of them for us to negotiate on so that the victim can get as much of what they need out of this process as possible, while also staying true to the needs of the case and to a just outcome in the case.
Okay, I'm sure the Sexual Assault Resource Center knows all that. So why did they release this publicly? Is there some tension between your office and them?
No, there's not. We're actually one of the offices that fund them. And I think their point is a good one, that we got to keep working on this together to make sure that we get better outcomes for victims. And part of that is pushing back together on the things that we can control, like court continuances. And that's not bashing judges. That's just part of the, you know, there are ways that we can work on this together and find ways to make the system better for victims.
Okay, to a number of other cases, including a murder case here, Seattle Police Chief Adrian Diaz announced arrests in three Seattle murder cases. All three of these defendants now facing murder charges filed by King County prosecutors. So let's go over which one those are.
This was first the case of the person who was sleeping on the steps of a town hall who was killed. That was a very tragic case. That one was charged as a first-degree murder case. And then there was the shooting on February 25th on the light rail train that was in between Seattle stops downtown. And then there was a March 6th shooting at a Belltown apartment. That was also charged as a first-degree case. So all three of those have been charged now. The defendants have arraignments next week. And then there's also that case in Tukwila last night where there was the shooting. There was a prosecutor from our office who was out at that scene and who's expected to follow that one all the way through.
Casey McNerthy from the King County Prosecutor's Office. Thank you, Casey.
Thanks a lot, Dave.
6:37 Seattle's Morning News. No one should have to choose between paying their rent and taking care of a family member, even if that family member is a pet. Here's Cairo News Radio's Mickey Gomez.
The cost for pet care is going up, and some families are forced into that situation. But King County families who are low to no income have a place to take their fur babies, the Donico Pet Clinic in Seattle, in part because a veterinarian and longtime clinic volunteer, Dr. Mona Redeshwar, closed her practice and gave all her equipment to Donico.
You guys want to come in and have a free clinic? And we worked it out. And I just kind of, that was my graceful exit from downtown.
Marty Casey is on the nonprofit's board and helps oversee the almost 40-year-old program.
And so now we are able to operate a full-service veterinary clinic for those qualified families, which is any family that is making 200% or less of the federal poverty limit.
Dr. Redeshwar tells her clinic story.
I opened my practice in downtown Seattle because there were no other practices down there, and I saw that it was going to be like a neighborhood.
And she says the practice was busy until...
And then the pandemic hit, okay, and the homelessness crisis arrived at our door.
But...
And then I just realized that, like, my staff didn't want to come to work anymore because it was, like, dangerous. Like, we were on the news all the time for crazy stuff that happened.
Red Eschwar says,
the real story is the homelessness crisis that was happening in Seattle. And me as a healer, like I was literally walking over bodies every morning to get to the front door of the clinic.
And that's when she called Marty Casey and donated all of her equipment. Red Eschwar says donating everything was a way to keep owners with their pets. And that's what matters most.
It's a story about, you know, people caring for other people. And like that is what is missing in this world right now. Like
the Free Pet Clinic has its forever home and is open in Seattle's Soto neighborhood. As long as families qualify, Donico will care for a pet for the remainder of its life. Mickey Gomez, Cairo News Radio.
Wow. Do they have room to keep this up long term?
Yeah, because they've been in service for about 40 years and now they're in partnership with King County. So that helps. And then, of course, they accept donations. And because of Dr. Redeshwar's, you know, generous donation, I think it was valued at over $150,000. You know, they're able to keep their doors open.
Wow. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. What happens when a hospital's computers are paralyzed by a ransomware attack? Let's page the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. So the latest ransomware attack brought down a major medical system. And I guess the question I have is this just the accounting computers, or do you have medical equipment that is hooked up to the network that could also be put in jeopardy by attacks like this?
Well, Dave, I think that's two questions. And let's start with the first one. Yeah, there's a company that was in late February. I think they detected the attack on February the 21st. It's a little-known subsidiary of United Health Group. And United Health Group is a major, major health company. But one of the components of their business is called Change Healthcare. Now, this company completes about 15 billion transactions a year. And it turns out that they were hacked on February the 21st. By a Russian hacker group, and Change Healthcare detected it and immediately shut their system down so that it would limit the amount of attacks that could happen. It would limit the extent of the attack. But as a result of shutting it down, it's created widespread financial challenges throughout the entire medical industry. So one of the things where, you know, people are starting to realize it on their own is when they go to the pharmacy, they can't process their insurance to get prescriptions filled. In some cases, people have, you know, manufacturer coupon cards to help reduce the cost of a prescription, and they're not able to use those. There is some suggestion that they, in fact, paid a ransom, and it turns out there was a $22 million Bitcoin payment. And, of course, this raises the concern that this shows how vulnerable the medical system is to being attacked and then, you know, paying up, so to speak.
Frankly, I don't know why the authorities allow Bitcoin. I think it should have been shut down long ago. But sounds like that battle's been lost. So what happens when they break into the systems then that run the medical equipment? I mean, if they can break into the billing equipment, how difficult would taking the next step be?
So I don't know if you remember, it was a pretty prominent story last August that some cyber criminals had attacked the computer systems of a California-based healthcare company, and it caused numerous emergency rooms in multiple states to actually close and for ambulance services to be redirected away from the hospitals that they were intended to arrive at. And the ransomware attack actually happened at a place called Prospect Medical Holdings in Los Angeles, and they happened to have numerous hospitals and clinics in Connecticut, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Texas, and so forth. And so they had to take their computer systems offline. But while that happened, it of course affected the ability of the hospitals to function. Now, there was no reports at that time that I'm aware of where they weren't able to actually run monitoring equipment or so forth. Rather, it had more to do with communications. And it sounds like the hospitals were able to go back to the old fashioned way of reporting things, you know, with paper and whatnot. But still, obviously, that risk exists. I mean, you know, I've always worried that there was a possibility that some cyber criminal could actually hack into like Medtronic's pacemaker systems and could actually affect people's pacemakers because they, you know, they can be monitored, you know, through the cloud now rather than having to use a specific device. It's things like that that I think I find very concerning.
I know in the Prospect case, it mentioned that elective surgeries had to be postponed. Other procedures were canceled. I mean, this is a big deal for people who've been waiting months to get an operation and suddenly the plug is pulled, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The entire healthcare system now, you know, in this century functions on data. You know, in the hospital, we communicate electronically. We get our labs electronically. X-rays are now done digitally and we pull them up on the computer to see them. Of course, CT scans and MRIs are all, you know, run into a computer and that's how we visualize them. And even, you know, when we're taking care of a patient, we're using, you know, monitors that are electronic and transmitting the patient's vitals and EKG and whatnot. Into the healthcare record directly. So you can only imagine that if you can affect those systems that are involved in taking care of patients, that again, it could create such problems for hospitals that they would have to stop taking care of patients. And in this case, you know, it's affecting patients so they can't even get their medications or they can't see their doctors. And in fact, in this particular case, you know, doctors aren't getting paid. So they're, you know, and they're complaining because they're running out of money to basically to run their practices. So this is an enormous, enormous problem.
I guess the answer is you pay the ransom.
Well, it sounds like they might have. And, you know, apparently it happens a lot more than we're aware of. But, you know, from what I've been reading, a lot of the cybersecurity experts really feel that paying the ransom is potentially problematic because it just encourages more of this.
Thank you, cryptocurrency. Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Thanks, Dr. Cohen.
Thanks, Dave.
Right now, our economic report. Every Monday, CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger gives us a briefing. And this week, I want to ask her about the job market because new jobs are being added at a record pace, and yet people still don't feel good about the economy.
So the job market is decelerating. It's not rolling over and getting horrible. It's changing, and that's okay. You cannot possibly have a job market that is creating 500,000-600,000 jobs a month. That's just, you know, impossible. So where we are is we've had job creation for about 3 years now, pretty steadily. And the amount of jobs that are being created is really solid right now. As you said, 250,000 a month for the past, say, 14 months. The unemployment rate is under 4% still. That's really good, although it is drifting up a little bit. It's the highest in about 2 years. And people are not quitting as readily because the job market is not quite as robust. That's fine. Does not mean that we are going into the tank. It means that we are going from red hot to lukewarm, and that's quite okay. Now, why is it that people don't feel quite as good about those results? Well, you know what I've done for you? I'm going to tell you how much I love you. Over the weekend, actually last week, I read an International Monetary Fund working paper.
Yikes.
By four economists. Are you asleep yet? Okay, I almost fell asleep. Anyway, I was interested in this because they were trying to understand why is it that people aren't feeling better. Right. Because they literally say that with the labor market is still firm and inflation is falling, why don't we feel better? And the quote is, this has confounded economists, because usually when those two things are happening, people feel better. So here's the thesis. It is about higher interest rates, meaning that if you're somebody who is carrying credit card debt, there's only $1.13 trillion in credit card debt. So there are millions of Americans who are in this situation. Your interest rate has gone up dramatically, right?
Yeah.
Huge, big jump. And if that's the case, you feel pressure. But that pressure is not reflected in the inflation data or in the jobs data. So you're feeling pressure. You may not feel good about your own situation because of the higher interest rates that we are seeing right now. And the same goes if you go out and get a new car loan, or you go out and you say, oh, I want to look for a house, and yet I can't afford it. So I think that it's the higher interest rates that have been higher for, you know, a while now that are that could be the cause that is weighing on our sentiment?
Well, I would say the answer to that is that instead of buying stuff first, then paying for it, pay yourself for the purchase you're about to make. Take advantage of the 5% interest rates and sometimes higher being given by banks and online savings institutions, and you forget your credit card.
Gosh, it seems so easy when you put it that way. You know, you're like me when I just want to say when I was a financial advisor, which is now already like 18 years ago, seriously. And I remember meeting with a client and was talking about life insurance. And I said, okay, I'm going through. Is anything that going to, you know, anything in your health history? And the guy's like, well, I smoke. I said, you know, you shouldn't smoke. That's yep. what you sound like right now.
Yeah, I know.
You shouldn't smoke.
They I know. Sorry.
They know. So anyway, that's part of the explanation for why we think that there is just a split. Now, and this is not really, you know, I would say that this is a better explanation than just say, oh, we're polarized and that, you know, the party that's out always feels worse about the party that's in and what's going on. I mean, it is inarguable that interest rates are higher. They've been higher for a while and the Federal Reserve is going to start reducing interest rates, but they haven't yet. And so I think that until that happens and people feel like we're on pace to see interest rates come down, they could continue to feel not so great.
We're hearing from CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger, as we do every Monday. And I wanted to settle a popular dinner table debate, because as Americans, we sit around our dinner table debating stuff. Is the U.S. economy doing well compared to other countries around the globe?
We are doing better than every developed nation. Every single one. Everyone experienced inflation. It was a global phenomenon, whether they gave money to their people or not. So, yes, you know, we could have had too much money go out a little bit late in the cycle, which contributed to interest rates. Yes, our Fed started to raise interest rates later than we would have liked. And at the end of the day, we are still ahead of every other developed economy in the world. And by the way, it is also true that prices are higher. And sometimes you just have to say to yourself and think this through is that, you know, it is true that these prices are higher, but things will get better and will go into more balance. So you don't have to freak out so much. It will get better. And we already know that wage growth is ahead of inflation growth right now. So that's mm-hmm. good. And by the way, the lower half of income earners are really, if you don't have credit card debt, you are in much better shape than you were 5 or 10 years ago if you're in the sort of middle class and lower.
Yeah.
Because of not everyone. Again, if you carry credit card debt, it's not good. But if you haven't, your wages are up even on an inflation adjusted basis.
And on the price thing, I think it's the fault of my generation, right?
It is true. I always love to blame you guys.
It's the old people because we have an aging population now thanks to the baby boom, but we'll be out of the way pretty soon. Anyway, while we're here, we can still remember when gas was 33 cents and a burger was 75 cents and, you know, and a stamp was a nickel. So, yeah, we think these prices are crazy. I mean, we went to a donut shop. A donut shop!
Darn it.
And ended up paying like $50 for, you know, a box of donuts. And now, they were high-class donuts, I'll admit to you. But I did sort of have to inhale as I saw the bill.
I understand that. And you know what? Every single person goes through that in some part of their lives.
Yes.
We get it. Of course, what we don't do is we don't imagine things like this. Dave sits there and says, donuts cost so much. And then on the flip side, Jill says, yeah, but look at your house value. It's
yes,
gone up
right.
by TK percent,
so
and
true.
So has your portfolio value. So everybody, it's hard. We're human beings. We are emotional. I hope to make you a little less emotional about this stuff.
Good point. I'll be quiet from now on.
No, don't.
CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Thank you, Jill.
Take care.
Your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. And thank you to Linda and Lacey, our listener, for pointing this one out to me. You know what they say, that it takes a village. Let's find out how that's happening in Arkansas. Here's CBS's Steve Hartman.
In Cabot, Arkansas, just as the sun begins to set over the local Walmart, store janitor Bill Majaluski begins walking to work for his overnight shift. He will trek 5 miles, 2 hours, in any weather.
I want to work.
He's going to go to work no matter what.
Let's go.
A couple years ago, Christy Conrad saw Bill out walking and offered him a ride. She got to know him, learned about his daunting daily commute, and how he's also
legally blind. So she began driving him whenever she could. At least, that's how it started.
Why did you feel the need to do more?
I can't be always there, you know?
So what was your plan?
Mr. Bill's Village.
Mr. Bill's Village is a Facebook group Christy started a couple months ago. She was hoping to find just a few volunteers to keep an eye out for Bill when he's walking.
And within days, it exploded.
It caught on really quick.
And now it's like everyone's competing to give Mr. Bill a ride.
They'll click and see, is Mr. Bill out walking? Is he headed to town?
So people are just driving around the streets looking for him?
Pretty much. Just like, where's Waldo, but where's Mr. Bill? Yeah. It's nice to see.
Today, the group has 1,500 members. In fact, here comes one now.
Hey, Mr. Bill.
Hello.
Do you need a ride to Walmart?
Oh, certainly.
All right.
Yeah.
Come on, hop on in.
You always get picked up now.
Pretty much.
Yeah. And it's always somebody different.
It's never the same person from one day to the next.
That's amazing.
There's a lot of good people in this world. All over the place, you know.
And on that note,
how are you?
Here's one more good person.
I'm pretty good.
Chris Puckett is a car dealer. My he wanted to give Bill a vehicle.
I wasn't aware that you couldn't drive.
But since Bill can't drive,
I'm legally blind.
I got you.
He handed the key to Christy instead.
Like, for real?
Putting the car in karma.
I don't even know what to say. Bill, go get in that front seat. Go over there.
Doing unto others. It's how they roll here in Mr. Bill's Village.
Thank you.
Bye, babe.
Bye, baby. I had to leave that little part in at the end. Bye, baby.
I like it.
I love Arkansas. Oh.
Further evidence that the American economy is booming. Russell Wilson already has a new job.
Mm.
And from the Gene Ursula Show, here is G. Scott.
Mm. You know, I wonder what it would be like to date someone that is already getting alimony, like dating someone that's already got a house
and they
already got payments coming
in.
That's what this is.
How much is Denver? Denver's paying him how much?
Just like a million.
$38 million.
Denver's paying
$38 million, and then the Pittsburgh Steelers just pay him $1.2 million. So it's like getting into a relationship with somebody who's like, you know, I've already got checks coming in. My house is paid off. I got a house over here. It's all good. So that's gonna be a good relationship. However, I do got good news.
Yes.
I believe that Russell Wilson to the Pittsburgh Steelers could be like me in my third marriage. Sometimes third time is the charm. So here it is. He's out there. He is going to be a Pittsburgh Steeler, number 3, year 13 for him,
oh, wow.
Right?
Yeah.
Pittsburgh Steelers going to pay him $1.2 million. The Denver Broncos are going to pay him $38 million.
Is he a starter?
For sure.
Okay, yeah, so he's going to be their starter.
Now,
okay.
Here's the thing. As a matter of fact, I was just texting with my buddy who lives in Pittsburgh. I was just texting with him. Hey, go ahead, you can check my... Usually I don't let people check my text messages because it's dangerous.
He has the privacy screen
Yeah. Look at this. 7:32, he just says, I'm excited about Russ. Don't read
he
the first part. He said more than that, yeah. But he says he's excited. And what is my comment right here is, reminder, the Steelers won 10 games last season. So if your expectations are above that, slow down, right?
Okay.
So there it is. They were 10-7. Last season, right?
Why do they need another quarterback then?
Because they were 10-7.
The idea and expectation is maybe Russell gets them over the hump. They were 10-7. Yes. Now, you know me, Colleen, we like to have fun. It's like in real life, right? Mm-hmm. So if you get with the guy and you already got your house paid off and your bills are paid and all this money that is coming in, right? And all of a sudden you get with this guy and you lose the house. You got to do better.
Yes.
So the Pittsburgh Steelers, the question will be, will they win more than 10 games next season?
Russell would say yes.
If they do or they don't, it really doesn't matter because of the investment that the Steelers are making. It's only a one-year deal.
Oh, I see.
They're giving him a shot.
Okay, I'm done. I'm done, y'all. If y'all say
so
I'm happy.
What's happening over in Denver, though? I mean, what has happened since that epic failure of a hire?
Okay.
Did the coaches get cleaned out? Mm-hmm. Who's their quarterback now? Mm-hmm. What's the fallout from Russell Wilson there?
So they had a first-year head coach in Nathaniel Hackett. and they made the idea. They made the trade. They bring Russell in. Russell comes over there. Let's ride. Comes to all of
them. Right? Rock the nation.
Let's ride. He comes over there. First day, he wears his own jersey to work. You know what I mean? Like, he could have worn anybody. By the way, I've been around this game for a long time. I've never seen guys wear their jersey to the practice facility. Huh. But anyways, he did that. And there's just a lot of things that happened. It didn't go well the first year. So they fire Nathaniel Hackett. And then they bring in Sean Payton, who is, you know, supposed to be the, ooh, we're going to fix everything. Sean Payton makes $18 million a season. So he's going to come in. He's going to fix everything. And, well, I guess midway through the season, he's like, yeah, I'm going to fix things, but I'm not going to fix it with this quarterback. So I'm going to get my own quarterback. So now they're going into year, it's going to be year two for Sean Payton. And they're going to be, we're going to find out what's going to happen with Denver. I don't think it's going to go as well in Denver as Denver thinks, right? Because sometimes it's not always about one person right. fixing everything. It's, believe it or not, it doesn't matter what kind of job you're at, where you are. You all know that at your job is not one person. That's the reason why things are going great.
That's right.
It's a culture. It's a collaborative effort that makes that. I don't think that's going to be going well in Denver, but that's just my opinion.
I'm just stunned that they have, what's the sunk cost for them? $36
million? 38.
38 million. So they pay $38 million for nothing. There must be so much money sloshing around the NFL
right?
to be able to do that.
Isn't that something? Dave, would you be the same person if you had $38 million?
Yes.
He would.
I don't believe you.
Oh,
Dave.
Please. Dave, nothing can change. He's steady. Okay, he's tried and true.
Would you drive the same car, Dave?
Yeah, he would.
Probably. Because when you get a new one, you got to learn all the new buttons and stuff. I might fly private.
Oh!
There you go.
Because
wow.
I do not like the hassle. Of spending 3 hours just to get on a plane.
What kind of food? Fancy. What kind of food would you have?
I don't really care about the food. It's the convenience of getting in the air, going to a place, landing, getting out, and being somewhat near the relative you're trying to visit.
Okay, on this Friday you'll be off on your Fridays. Where would you go?
I'd probably go to Connecticut more often. Yeah, see the other grandchild.
Visit the grandchild. I love bougie Dave.
Time out.
Yeah.
So you get a private jet. Yeah. You go to Connecticut.
It's a nice state.
Simple man, simple pleasures. We still have to bring him to Vegas, though. Yeah. Can you promise to fly his private to Vegas and we'll show you a good time?
I don't. What would I do?
This is a hypothetical situation in which you have $38 million. Okay, just say yes.
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely.
Dave, let's go party.
I can send someone to play the games for me.
There you go.
Would you let me style you?
Yeah.
Be your stylist?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Oh, we go on a shopping spree in Vegas.
I really like the way you look today, but I don't think I can pull it off.
You wouldn't wear pearls?
I don't think I could pull off. People would see something different with me in pearls than they see with you in pearls.
I could see you in some Nike Dunks.
Yeah.
I can see you in Nike Dunks.
Well, good for you.
Yeah. It's fun to dream.
I know. I'm just kidding. This is all sing-along. I'm just Ken. It's Mickey time. Mickey watched the Oscars. David Burbank watched the Oscars. Colleen watched the Oscars.
I didn't watch the Oscars. I caught the highlights.
Yeah, I watched the best moments.
Yeah.
I watched them at sort of, you know, double speed to save time. Anyway, Mickey, what were the best moments for you?
Well, for me was when Divine Joy Randolph won her award for The Holdover. She won for Best Supporting Actor. And I was in... I didn't drop tears, but my eyes watered when I listened to her speech, because as a person who has always lived in a bigger body and who has brown skin, just to know that, you know, that you can break barriers and that you can inspire other little girls to do the same, to know that you belong in those rooms and in those acting classes and on stage to accept an Oscar was just inspiring.
So...
do we have her speech?
We do.
I thought we did. Oh, yeah, I'll play it.
Well, you've got it.
I didn't think I was supposed to be doing this as a career. I started off as a singer, and my mother said to me, go across that street to that theater department. There's something for you there. And I thank my mother for doing that. I thank you to all the people who have stepped in my path and has been there for me, who has ushered me and guided me. I am so grateful to all you beautiful people out here. For so long, I've always wanted to be different. And now I realize I just need to be myself. Thank you.
That was a big one.
Yeah, yeah, it definitely was. John Cena, what was up with that?
He still got it. Wow. For how old he is, I was surprised that his body was still that tight.
I don't think I needed to know the anatomy of John Cena. I mean, I'm going to be honest with you.
I also think about the double standard of if like a female actress had gone out there, or even like, you know, whatever his equivalent would be, it would just be controversy, right? But instead, everybody's like, all right, yeah. John Cena's body.
No, that was too much. I was like, no, thank you. I know that Dave and I were talking about Jimmy Kimmel calling out Trump at the Oscars, reading his tweet on air, you know, about how he, so that was,
so
that was also
interesting.
The president
was really live, whatever, his
live
Truth
tweeting.
Social media-ing during the Oscars.
Yeah.
That's bizarre.
Yeah, he said that there's never been a worse host than Jimmy Kimmel, and then, of course, Kimmel read all of that on air, and so that was suggested
George Stephanopoulos instead, because he would make everybody feel big and handsome. I was like, this is embarrassing. One, he called it out, and I think his punchline was, aren't you late for prison time?
No,
or
he says, aren't you way past your jail time?
Yeah. Aren't you way past your jail time? Yeah, but, you know, to give the airtime, embarrassing.
What did you think about Oppenheimer winning most of the awards last night?
Unsurprising.
Yeah. Was it? Yeah. I mean, I thought I saw Oppenheimer. I was on a 3-hour flight. And so I said, you know what? I'm going to do it. I'm going to go in, because Colleen and I were actually supposed to go watch it, but busy moms, we never did. But I thought it was really good, especially when you get to the climactic moment,
It didn't feel like 10 hours, I'm telling you.
But the
movie or the Oscars?
The movie.
Okay. But do you think that Barbie got its due, though?
No.
Because it got, the song should have won, obviously, Billie Eilish and her brother Phineas. They should have, that song was incredible, and it still gives me chills and the message behind it. But it didn't get anything else, right?
Other than best costume design.
Okay,
it didn't win for costume design. I'm so sorry. No, it did win. It was best original song, What Was I Made For?
That's it.
Yeah. Barbie,
I feel like even adapted screenplay. I mean, Greta Gerwig didn't get anything.
I know,
in all of the awards ceremony.
And what was interesting to me was that it felt like Barbie was the narrative, even though it didn't win any of the big awards.
Yeah.
It was, well, but even of the show, I mean, the live performances, both from Ryan Gosling and from Billie Eilish, I think it captured, at least from what I saw on the internet, from what all the clips that were showing up, everything that you see on X, that was the story. That and locally, at least, Lily Gladstone not winning for
that was
best
a bummer
actress.
For me.
That was an upset.
Yeah,
for sure.
I wanted America Ferrera to win for her speech, but I was still glad that it went to Divine. I wasn't mad at that, but if I had to pick, I would have said America.
Has anybody here seen Poor Things?
I have not seen Poor
Things. I've seen a million clips pop up, and none of them are particularly.
It was one of those sneaker movies where the actor or actress knows they're making an Oscar-worthy movie, and then they campaign like right as the Oscars hit. And you're like, where did this come from? And all the Barbie fans are going, what is happening? And she got best actress.
I was surprised at that. I really was. I was like, come on.
I suppose it is difficult to act like you have a baby's brain inside an adult's body. So for like that acting feat, I'm sure that's why the Academy. But I just wanted more for Barbie.
Any shockers for you, Dave?
No, okay. Not really.
What about the fashion? We know you were looking at that.
I can't even comment on it anymore. It just has to get more and more over the top each year. But these are all like one-time dresses, right? I mean, you don't keep these in your closet and never wear them again, right?
No, it's a one-time show.
Sometimes they get auctioned off. Sometimes they go to, you know.
Sometimes they wear couture that's like archived, where they'll just pull a dress
out. I do like
the
live production numbers, I will say. As a former amateur thespian myself, to be able to pull something that complicated off on live TV, I think is
I did like that.
Cool.
I did like that Jimmy Kimmel recognized, the people behind the scene.
I thought that was huge.
Yeah, and then he said, I'm gonna make us very, very late, so all of you can have a lot of overtime.
Yeah.
I'd
like to point out David Burbank, who is behind the scenes a lot on our show, and you do a great job.
Of course, you like that part a lot, David.
At least more.
But you're not getting overtime. So.
Yeah, that's it. That's the difference here. No overtime for you, but lots of compliments.
Yes.
Thank you, Mickey. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.